Her research focuses on three areas: high-risk work settings and work occupations, disaster preparedness and occupational health, and the translation of epidemiological research findings into organizational practices and regulatory control. Dr. Gershon has received her doctorate in public health from Johns Hopkins University School of Public Health. Please welcome Dr. Gershon.
Thank you, and good morning. It's very hard to be here thinking about these public health issues, which, granted, arguably are terribly important, but right now unfolding in front of us is a major master disaster. Just I'm thinking about mold, what's going to be happening with flooding. It's very hard to wrap my head around, and I feel kind of torn that I'm here, and New York City, of course, is my home city, and it's just dreadful, but glad to be here nonetheless. Today I'll be talking about a study that is based upon an earlier study that we did about 4 years ago, part of my occupational health and safety kind of hat that I wear. And that study looked at the household hazards that presented a risk to home healthcare workers. We were studying a population of healthcare workers that are very, very rarely studied. And when we started looking at that and actually going to the households and collecting a lot of risk assessment data, we realized right away that the hazards they were being exposed to were quite easily hazards that could present a tremendous threat to their patients. And for the most part, patients in the home healthcare setting, of course, are elderly. So that was the study that was funded by ARC. It led to the development of a very cute and easy household tool, a hazard assessment tool. I had a poster on it the other day. I do have that tool. I can send you if you'd like it. The tool that we developed for this study, which was funded by HUD, was a little more evolved. I'll show you a picture of it. I have some slides on it. And this is another tool that's accessible. I can send it to you it's a Word document. You can tailor it. The reason that we use a photo illustrated tool is that many of our home healthcare aides, when we developed the first one with the ARC funding, are not English speakers. And we wanted to make a very simple, cost-effective tool that they could use in their patient's home to identify household hazards easily. And it turned out to be a very well-accepted tool, and so did this. So both of those tools are available, including some training materials for community outreach. So these are some of my co-authors. Tara Alexander is here with us today. She was our project coordinator. This was a little bit of a bear of a study to do, I'm sure the way yours were as well, because actually the intervention itself was relatively simple. It was collecting all the data, and this was a pre-post design intervention study. So that was the part that was a little difficult, including getting back to these elderly householders and getting back into their homes to do the reassessment. But Tara did a great job, so thank you, Tara. I do not have any financial disclosures to make. Basically, I'll go through these few things in the brief time that I have, and I want to jump right in. I think for most of us here in this room, we all would agree households clearly can be very unsafe environments, especially for children and the elderly. This is very well demonstrated through a number of different hazard assessment studies. The thing that was striking for me, and in fact is true even in my own household, after a while you fail to see the hazards under your nose. In fact, over time, they just become part of the landscape. And I think this is what happens in many of the cases when hoarding or excessive clutter is a problem. It comes very incrementally. You don't notice it. A few more papers, a few more books, a few more, and the next thing you know, you can't really move around the room. So having these kinds of tools that just, you know, catch your eye and say, oh, okay, I've got that, let me do something about it. So that was the main thing. And one of the problems that the community we worked in was a low income, definitely an underprivileged community in northern Manhattan. And remediation in these apartment buildings, some of whom live in public housing, is a little bit of a problem because is it the superintendent? Is it the home leaser, the renter? Is it the homeowner, the person who owns the building? Is it the city? Is it, you know, it's kind of everyone and no one. And whose responsibility is it becomes a big issue. These are just some data I'm sure you're very familiar with. A lot of people don't realize this, but falls are the leading cause of injury-related death in older adults in the U.S., so it has tremendous implications, morbidity and mortality associated with it. And of course, as you so nicely pointed out, the cost of some of these is enormous. The burden is incredible. Again, the problem is, who will pay for our remediation? Who will pay? How can we get a third-party payer to absorb the cost that can lead to tremendous reductions in cost to them when it's not really a health-related cost, but of course it is. Not surprisingly, maybe for some of you, burns are the number two leading cause of death and injury in elderly. So we designed this study with a pre-post design. Our goal was to implement our checklist using it as a visual inspection tool, followed by a remediation, then followed 3 months later by a reinspection. And of course, we also had a number of different well-validated surveys to assess the impact on the participant, including taking data, getting data on their falls or near misses and stuff like that, injuries that they had had, both in the prior 3 to 12 months and in the 3 months between the intervention and our follow-up. I believe in Tara, tell me if I'm wrong, I believe the follow-up was about 60-65% of the householders. Tremendous effort to get back into these households. It was tremendous effort to first get into their households, but then to get ourselves back into the households was kind of difficult. So this is a little bit more about the design. This was a participatory action research framework that we used. Clearly, you need that desperately to get this kind of engagement of community members. We did our collection and our recruitment through senior centers located within that neighborhood, so that was kind of a convenient way to actually recruit people into the study. They were very willing once we met with them, and they came to trust us and understand that we weren't going to report them if they were an undocumented, I don't want to use the words, but undocumented people. And so after a while, that trust was built, and lots of visits to the senior centers and breakfasts and lunches and that sort of thing, and eventually they came to trust us and allow us into their homes. The poverty that we saw on these home visits, really, I would say it took my breath away. And the one thing that I know Tara and I have talked about this, one thing that really struck me that I was really unaware of was the level of food insecurity in some of these elderly people. They were actually going from senior center to senior center throughout the day to get breakfast and then go to the next place to get lunch. And at that place, they would take stuff home to have for dinner later that night. They literally could not afford to eat. And in a city like New York City, I just simply, it took my breath away. I had no idea it was that severe. So these are some of the data that we collected. We did have MPH students that we recruited to be our interveners. They were trained, they were fabulous. We did eventually develop it so that community members themselves or families of elderly people could actually use this checklist and figure out the easy, no-cost or low-cost remediations. But for this study, because we had a lot of these different surveys, we did involve the MPH students, and it was a great project for them. All of our MPH students had to be fluent in both English and Spanish because the target neighborhood was primarily Spanish-speaking. And what's going on? Okay, so the survey itself, that's this thing. I know it looks long, but that's because a lot of things had to be repeated because we did living room, kitchen, bedroom, you know, that sort of thing. Now, most people lived in just one or two rooms. Some people rented a room from somebody else in the neighborhood. In that case, we did their room and the kitchen and the bathroom, the common areas. Some people just rented a couch. In that case, we visited the room where their couch was, where they rented the couch, and then we did the bathroom and the kitchen if they had kitchen privileges where they lived. So it was a little bit dependent on their living situation. Interestingly enough, the inspections took only between one, well, because there were very few rooms that we had to look at, between 1 and 1.5 hours to complete, and that included the remediation. And it was a fabulous opportunity for public health communication, and I can't help but feel you, if you move into a lead building, a fabulous green building, if you're not given the tools to keep it that way, you're totally defeating the whole process. So having this opportunity was great. And interestingly enough with us, when we went around doing the inspections, I would say, am I right, Tara? I'd say 100% of the time, the person whose household we were inspecting came with us. They loved doing the survey with us. They loved. They had their list, and we were showing them, look at the mold, look at this. They enjoyed it, and in a lot of cases, their family members came with us, too. So that was kind of neat. And these were some of our eligibility and exclusion criteria. We did ask at the outset when we recruited them to please, we don't want to go into households where there are active bed bug infestations, because at that time, this was about several months ago, in New York City, we had a bad bed bug problem, and this was done when I was at Columbia, they were pretty adamant about our not bringing back bed bugs back to the university. So, wisely. So we would suit up, and you know, we had a lot of bags that we brought, and all of our book bags in and everything, but as far as I know, none of us got bed bugs, or new bed bugs, let's put it that way. We also didn't want to go into households where there were dangerous pets, so they had to have them secure, or we did not go. And we developed all kinds of things. It's amazing what you could get. We got a lot of stuff from Target by simply calling them up and saying, we're doing this public health study, we need stuff for our safety goodie bags, and we do help us out. We only have 100 or so people in the study. We don't need a lot of stuff. And people were very forthcoming, and we got a lot of stuff that way. And that really kept down the cost of the remediation, and the goodie bags were essentially, for the most part, free. The fire department gave us smoke detectors, CO detectors, even the fire extinguishers, I think we got at a very good rate. We got lots of goodies. If you put in a few hours of work, and we actually have a list of the places we went to, some of which are national. Definitely these are New York-centric places, so if you ask, you know, it doesn't hurt to ask. These were some of the goodies in the goodie bag. Lots of goodies in them. They were really happy with that. And this is what the checklist looked like. And you can see, I don't know if you can see it, but we had a thing here about we did the correction, and we actually checked that we did the correction. In this case, we were changing the light bulbs. One of the big problems we noticed right away, how much low lighting. I mean, the lighting was a big issue, and I don't know if it was the windows were not very good, and they didn't have good natural lighting, and they didn't have bulbs, light bulbs, and a lot of the lamps that they did have and the few that they had were very, very low wattage. It was strange, but we did change those out. And then you can see from here all the other things that we were kind of looking at room by room, right? And the correction and the education, the community education that was provided. And these are just some more of the pictures that we used to highlight. So we got the pictures off of open source web. In the cases where we couldn't find it, we actually took our own pictures. This is not any of ours refrigerators, though, as far as I know. But these were available, and that's why if you want to use this, you can go ahead and put your own logo on. We did not copyright it because they were a federally funded study, so you can put your own logo, you can change out the pictures. We wanted to make it very accessible. And of course, we were focusing, being from New York City, we focused a lot on vermin. But in this age group, we focused a lot on clutter. And these are the results. So we had 105 households that we enrolled into the study. Majority were male. The average age was 75, basically Hispanic, and less than half with high school education. The baseline results, we're just reporting now for you the baseline, but we're analyzing the pre-post data. There were a lot of burns, and I know you're over at Mount Sinai, and I don't know if you see this over there, but I was frankly surprised, even though I did see in the literature that burns are a big deal. And when we visited their kitchens, I could see why. I mean, some of them are the old-fashioned kitchens with the knobs over here and the burners are here, or they're, you know, typical New York City kitchens, very tight, very, very tight. So to reach out, and if you had a bathrobe or a sleeve, so they were mainly having kitchen burns. Although there were some burns related to the use of candles that slip over, people smoking in their bed, falling asleep with the cigarette, so it was that kind of thing. Of course, there were lots of falls. It turned out to be almost 2 falls per person in the prior year, and I believe that that's about the national average. I think that's about right. These burns are probably about right, too. It was high. Interestingly, 1% of the sample had an ED visit due to prescription med error. For the most part, the wrong meds or the too much, you know, double dosing. And so one of the goodie bag things was this very cute little, you know, pill sorter. We noticed a lot. We did look in their medicine cabinet. We did notice a lot of expired drugs, a lot, and drugs with other people's names on them, drugs in the kitchen, drugs all over the place, and very poor. That would be a very interesting kind of study in and of itself. A lot of problems with that. And 4% of our sample did report some form of elder abuse, which we reported back to our participating senior center to work through their social services sector to do the follow-up. And these are the most common hazards that we saw. Again, like I said, the lighting, peeling paint, of course. Lead is not as much an issue for this population. These are elderly. A lot of problems with rodents, both mice, mostly mice in our case, not so much rats. Uneven flooring, very old housing stock, very in poor in disrepair. Lots of roach problems, molds. And this was one or more in one or more rooms or near your couch if you rented the couch. Clutter was a big issue. It turned out to be only about $20 to $25 an apartment to do the remediation because if we could not do it because, let's say, it was a very extensive mold problem, Tara filled out work orders. Those work orders were placed with the housing, and actually we followed up on those work orders, and for the most part, they actually did get done. But you need to sit on the phone and be on hold. Very, I would say, labor-intensive, and I can't imagine that these householders would have been able to do it on their own. So having that MPH student, you know, in there following up was very critical. We reassessed them, so we had a 63% follow-up rate. That data I'll report probably next year's meeting, if not before then. And that's where I'll stop, save room for questions. So thank you very much. And I do have copies with me. Thank you.